704-548-WINE.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. This hour is designed around design. Later, we find out how Blumenthal Performing Arts has been designing increasingly successful seasons of entertainment and how, in the process, the city's profile has been raised to the point where we now get major hit shows before some of the larger cities. First, though, the kind of design that surrounds us in our everyday lives, and at least one man who has worked to improve access to well-designed products that we use every day in the kitchen. This Thursday and Friday, the Mint Museum is sponsoring a FOOD conference. That stands for Food, Objects, Objectives, and Design. And they're bringing to town one of our guests in the first part of the program. Michael Graves is an internationally renowned architect and designer and founder of Michael Graves & Associates. He's also well known for his democratization of design through his partnership with and his successful product line, first for Target and now for JCPenney. And he joins us by phone. Welcome to the program and welcome to Charlotte. Nice to have you with us, Mr. Graves.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And Cheryl Palmer is also here in our studio. She's Director of Learning and Engagement at the Mint Museum, of course, the sponsors of this exhibit, which is actually part of the Mint Museum of Craft and Design, which is housed within the Mint downtown on Tryon Street. It's very complicated, but welcome to United.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks, Mike.
What is this food FOOD conference, and at whom is it aimed?
Well, it's aimed for foodies and as well for folks who love art and design. The exhibition, which opened in March, is just extraordinary. It pulls from our own collection at the Mint Museum, everything from pre-Columbian chocolate pots to English Staffordshire 18th century teapots and teacups and things like that, to very contemporary design, which is part of our name, Craft and Design. So we have a Michael Graves teapot and a Michael Graves minute timer and trivet, and wonderful things that converge this essence of utilitarian and functionality, but things that you want to feel good in your hands, and there's an aesthetic to them. There's an aesthetic decision about them, whether they were made in ancient Maya times or they were made in a factory today. Mm-hmm. So the food conference explores that, again, convergence of utilitarian and beauty and aesthetics. Michael Graves will kick everything off tomorrow night, Thursday night, with a wonderful program. And then all day Friday is the food conference, where we're bringing in culinary historians, chefs, designers, artists, graphic designers, and all of them make decisions and will reflect on things such as the global nature of our kitchens these days and what's in our pantry. There may be a can of Goya beans next to a jar of Indian basmati rice and a jar of Italian olive oil. But these folks are, I would say, stars in their respective fields, as Mr. Graves is in his.
You know, I saw, I was at the Mint a couple weeks ago and I saw this exhibit and was racing through. I was there for like an hour and I was just racing through things, so I didn't really pay close attention. I was just looking at the objects, not looking at who made them. And I did see, Mr. Graves, one of your teapots, and I thought, that's really wonderful. I'm sure it's too expensive for somebody like me to buy. And now that I know it's yours, I know that it's not too expensive for me to buy. And that's the one of the magical things about what you do, because you started with high-end products and you've moved toward this democratization. Is it as satisfying for you? Is it challenging for you to design a product that doesn't sell for $1,000 that you can buy for $50 at JCPenney?
Well, actually, it's a little more challenging to design at the lower end because you have to hit the price, or it doesn't go to market. So if I design for Cartier's or Tiffany's or somebody like that, price is generally not an object. But when you design for Penny's or Target or even Alessi, price is also an issue. And you have to get there to get it, as I say, to get it to market. And that's a change, mm-hmm. A big change, because in the 20s and 30s, during the time of the Bauhaus, and even a little before that in Vienna, a group called the Vienna Workshop. Vienna was a center for design headed by Joseph Hoffman. But they, both the Vienna Workshop and the Bauhaus, tried desperately to get their products to market through with lower prices, but they were all handmade. Mm-hmm. Even when they looked like they were made by machine, the famous Barcelona chair, not made a little after that time by Mies van der Rohe, was made to look like it was made by a machine, but it was all handcrafted. They were so enamored with the machine, but they couldn't make it work. What we did at Target was, with a big box store, you, of course, have many, many products being made at once, 1,700 stores times, 5 or 6 objects per store of a certain type, a tea kettle, let's say, and you've got a huge number, and that's all made by mass production, and that's what makes the difference. And we are accomplishing now what the Bauhaus wanted to do, and they call it democratization of design.
What is it about good design that attracts people to it, that makes them want to have that object over something that will serve the same function but just isn't as attractive or as well designed, so to speak?
Well, you said the two magic words, function, mm-hmm. and attraction or appearance. You put them together, and there is generally an experience using that object.
Let me use one of your objects as an example of something, because I didn't know this until yesterday when I was looking at the JCPenney website and looking at some of the things that you make for them. You know, a toaster is a toaster is a toaster. It makes bread, and you know, if it's a good toaster, it'll make it evenly toasted on both sides. But your toaster is something that I think is too cool for words, because it looks like a loaf of bread. Now, why is that important? Why do I find it amusing? I find it something that I would really like to have in the kitchen because it's just cool. It's a conversation piece, and I'm sure it works well. Why is that so exciting to me?
Just because of what you said. I got a letter from a mother who said her child watches the little piece of toast. We have a tiny piece of toast by the clock and all of that on the side of the toaster, and it turns from bread to toast to show you how well the toast is doing. She said the child can't take its eyes off the toast. And another person wrote me and said they're not a toast person, but they had to have the toaster because of how it appeared. And then they said, now it works so well, I've gotten back to toast. And so I have toast every morning. I mean, those are nice stories. They're not going to change the world, but they're nice stories.
Well, you did a lot of high-end design. You're an architect, and you do things other than just design. And in fact, I didn't know this till yesterday either, but the way you made the connection with Target is that you designed the scaffolding for the refurbishing of the Washington Monument, because they came to you to do it, and Target was the sponsor. They were paying for it. I guess they got to pick the architect that fixed the scaffolding, and that's how you got into this. But once you got into designing products for the masses, in addition to products for high-end stores, did you worry that it would diminish you as a designer in some way?
I thought about it, but I didn't worry about it because, as I said to you, it's now accomplishing something that we all wanted. And I, frankly, couldn't afford some of the things I was designing for other people. And so now with Target, I could go in and buy anything on the shelf. I could afford all of those things. Sometimes I afforded too many of them, and I would overspend. But
you didn't get them free?
I didn't get them free. That's Target. Come on.
You are bringing, Cheryl, you're bringing, as you said, writers and historians and chefs and designers and graphic artists together as part of this conference. What are the writers and historians and graphic artists doing at the conference, and what is their contribution to all of this, design versus food versus the kitchen and our lives?
Well, they are bringing together a lot of chops, a lot of smarts. Several of them are James Beard Foundation winners. Dr. Jessica Harris has written 11 cookbooks about the African diaspora. So that sort of global exchange of foods and foodstuffs and cultures is something that she'll be able to address. Dara Goldstein is another culinary historian. She is the founding editor of a wonderful magazine called Gastronomica, which is a journal of food and culture, mm-hmm. the two coming together. And she too sees that international play. Matteo Bologna, who lives in New York now, but obviously is from somewhere else, is the principal designer of Mooka Design. They have won James Beard Foundation Awards for their menu designs and graphic branding for high-end restaurants in New York City. Mm. Then we've got Peter Reinhardt, who's wonderful and in our own backyard, chef on assignment with Johnson & Wales, who's revolutionized, I think, our thinking about bread and pizzas. And so these folks, this is not going to be PowerPoint presentations by all these different people. They're going to be sitting together at table. How perfect. Table, what we celebrate within the exhibition as a coming together of people and exchanges of ideas. And they're going to be talking with moderators about issues of, again, globalization, sustainability, thinking about the kitchen as now, there's an architect, Ken Gaylord, who's on the program. He's being asked to design bigger and bigger kitchens with more technology and more appliances and more space for things. Why is the kitchen this heart of the home? Why do we have Food Network and all of this new phenomenon, fairly recent phenomenon, around food and preparation and serving of food? Those are the sorts of things that we'll be able to explore, and the audience will be able to ask their questions too.
Design, products that look neat, cool, interesting, that they are more than simply their function. When did that come into importance? Was it a 20th century phenomenon when design first made its way into the modern psyche or into the average household, or is that something that's always been around? Was Leonardo da Vinci a great designer? We just didn't think of it as design. We thought of it as art and architecture.
Well, he was a great designer, and he was designing airplanes and a variety, and equipment for war, etc. But I think it came even earlier than that. I think Josiah Wedgwood in the 18th century had a manufactory in England, in Staffordshire, England, trying to produce products both for the market actually in the colonies, but also for Queen Charlotte at the time, mm-hmm. but also for a growing merchant class, so to speak, so that there was an aesthetic. It was manufactured. It was reproduced in multiples, but you could own a wonderful teapot, and maybe it had on its face or on its surface something commemorative. They were doing things about George Washington after the colonies became the states, for an exchange with the states for our customers here. But I do think, to your point, modern sensibilities did come in the 20th century.
Cheryl Palmer is the Director of Learning and Engagement at the Mint Museum. They're sponsoring the FOOD, Food Objects Objectives Design Conference, Thursday and Friday at the Mint. Michael Graves, our other guest, speaks there at 7 o'clock, and we'll come back with more of our conversation about design in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting an evening with Lyle Lovett and his acoustic group, The Modern Embodiment of Texas Music, in Belk Theater, Monday, May 6th. Tickets at 704-372-1000. Well, the Charlotte region is made up of towns, a lot of towns, much smaller than Charlotte, and as we grow here in Charlotte, they do too. But their struggle is not to become just another bedroom community of Charlotte. They struggle to keep their identity and their history, and we talk about how these smaller towns stimulate economic growth of their own and cope with all the other things they have to deal with us in the middle of it all, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm show, FAA furloughs of air traffic controllers are causing flight delays around the country. How the fight over budget cuts is affecting air travel.
Join the Diane Rehm show for that discussion from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the upcoming food conference. FOOD means Food Objects Objectives Design Conference at the Mint Museum, actually the Craft and Design Museum in the Mint Uptown. It's Thursday and Friday. Cheryl Palmer is here, Director of Learning and Engagement there, and Michael Graves, architect, designer, founder of Michael Graves and Associates, and the designer of the now very famous and ubiquitous product line at Target and at JCPenney that's affordable yet high style. I understand, Michael, that you became paralyzed by an illness and challenged designers and architects to make objects usable and accessible. Why wasn't that always a key ingredient?
Well, I think before my paralysis, I adhered to the law, ADA and so on, and obviously all architects do. Nothing new there, but after paralysis, I realized that the law doesn't go far enough, and I have since joined President Obama's Access Board in Washington, and am trying to do something about our federal buildings and other places in the United States that need access. But it's more than access. It's this symbol of what we are trying to do. For instance, people have said to me now for a new city hall, let's say, in Charlotte, you wouldn't use steps anymore, would you? You'd just glide in from the sidewalk and with nothing that the handicap can't do. Hmm. But on the other hand, a city hall might want steps to have its elevated symbol read to by the public in a subliminal way. And so I say, no, not necessarily. Let's have the steps, but let's have the ramp as well and design the ramp into the system so that it's every bit as important and as good looking as the steps are. It's a small thing, but it's a psychological lift for me to know that we can do that sort of thing.
That's big stuff. The small things that you design for stores, for retail, being paralyzed, did it change the way you looked at the objects that you were designing?
Well, actually, no, because I was designing for Target before paralysis, and I said, if we're going to make these objects, we've got to make objects that are good to hold. If you're 85, if you're arthritic, if you're a child, I want you to know which end is up, which is the business end of the object. I don't want it so abstract that you don't know, as many modern objects are. But I want it to feel good in your hand. We made a neoprene handle that actually gave a little bit. I mean, it had a little softness to it, so the arthritic person could hold on to it quite well. And those were important things to me before paralysis, and we've just increased that after.
Has the advent of technology and the increasing amount of technology in our lives enhanced product design, made it more difficult, made it more challenging, made it more satisfying if you've come up with a solution to incorporate some of these new things into old objects?
I'm pretty slow that way. I wait till things have been tested. Early on in my architecture days, I tried a product from 3M, and it didn't work, and I dearly paid the price for it. And I learned an important lesson. I want, when I use new materials, I want to make sure that they're going to endure, and they're going to do what they say they're going to do, and that's not just hype. So you've got to be very careful with new technology. But once it's proven, there's nothing like it. You can use it and prosper from it.
I looked through the catalog of products that you're designing right now for JCPenney, and you have that toaster we talked about, a slow cooker, a coffee maker, a teacup, a waffle maker, a Dutch oven, among other things. And the amazing thing is that all of these are under $100, many just over or at $50. But a slow cooker, we'll just take that for example. What's the difference in your slow cooker and anybody else's slow cooker? And did the world need another slow cooker? Obviously they did, or they wouldn't have asked you to design it. But what, when you think about something like that, how do you make it unique? How do you put your stamp on it?
Well, that's a very good question, because there wasn't much to do to the slow cooker. We have a few more dials on it and things that you can do. If I were a cook, I could tell you why you do all of that, but I'll leave that to Martha. The cooker works brilliantly, I'm told. In fact, I just gave one as a gift. I was so proud of it. It also has a little object on the bottom that is not a part of function at all, but again, a part of the psychology of that sort of thing. It sits on what are horizontal, not vertical legs, as if it were on a wooden fire, and you had logs underneath it. And when you turn it on, a red light below lights up so that you know it's on, and that's to indicate fire and so on.
Wow.
But it's just another bell or whistle to enhance its saleability.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. You were brought into JCPenney when the now gone CEO came in, I believe from Apple, and he had experience with the Apple stores, and everybody knows about Apple's design and how successful they are at making elegant products that actually work in the computer world. But it's also no secret that JCPenney is struggling. The man who brought you in is gone. You're a designer, and you look at problems and how to solve them. How would you solve their problem?
Well, Ron Johnson is the man you're talking about, and we first met him at Target. And he's the one that really got me going at Target. He was the visionary that saw what I could do. He looked at one of my sketchbooks one day in a meeting and said, "You should be putting these things on our shelves," and so that's how that got started from the Washington Monument. And then Ron went to Apple for 10 years, and then had a chance to run a department store, and he took the chance, and that was of course Penny's. But Ron asked for a lot, and he needed time, and I think that if there had been time and patience, Ron would have changed the store. He said to me, when he called me, he said, "I don't want to do just the best department store. I want to do America's favorite store." Mm. I would probably give it a little more time, because it's going to be there. It's such a joy to go into it, to a Penny's today as from when the old days. But Mike Ullman is the new CEO, and he's every bit as gifted as Ron, perhaps a little more frugal, and that will make the difference.
Yeah. Since given your success, your great success with these products, first at Target, now at JCPenney, why haven't more high-end designers, or maybe they have, come down and started producing things for the masses that will enhance our lives? Why haven't more people gotten into this game?
Well, there are people in Europe that have, people like Philippe Starck. I went to a restaurant here in Charlotte last night and sat on a Philippe Starck chair. But there are people like that, and in Italy and in France, mostly in Italy, and a few in Japan, that are doing what I do. But it is surprising that not very many Americans do it. Maybe they simply haven't been asked or don't show the interest that I've always had in it. I've always thought that it's part of the responsibility of the architect to design the interiors of their building, and it doesn't take long before the interiors become the kitchen, and the kitchen becomes the spatula. And so we did it all. But I remember when I started, 20 years ago, I was introduced at a conference, not unlike the food conference, by an older architect, a member of the AIA, and he made fun of me for doing what I was doing. I'm sure he's eating his words today, but but nevertheless, it was thought to, they thought that they were looking down on design. After all, they were architects. And but then so was I.
I want to hear from both of you about this. When you mentioned Italy, Italians are known for being very concerned with the way things look. I guess also the way they function. But if you look at Italian design, that's one of their hallmarks. That they make very cool looking things. Why aren't Americans as concerned about the way things look as the Italians or the French, for that matter?
Do you want me to answer that?
Sure, go ahead.
I think they are. And I think it's changed. When we first started working for Alessi, 1985, he said, "Well, you know, you Americans aren't as concerned with appearance and functionality as we Italians are." And I think he would change his tune today. I think we are every bit as concerned. Look at the automobile industry. It's the best barometer, I think. What we're doing today is equal to what Toyota is doing and what Honda is doing and so on. And those cars, after all, are designed by Americans in California.
Yeah.
So I think the American design has just got this marker against it that will take years for it to get rid of. But I lived in Italy for 2 years at the American Academy in Rome. And somebody said to me once, we were walking behind this young man of about 18 who was wearing a blue suit and a white shirt and a good tie and black shoes. And so he was going to a wedding or something. But they said, you know, it's interesting about the Italian middle class. That's his only suit, they would say. He doesn't, unlike some of our people, they go to a discount house and buy 3 or 4 suits, so they have a change. Instead of doing that, the Italians put all their money in one good thing instead of a lot of mediocre things.
Different way of looking at the world, I suppose.
You
have said, Cheryl, that this upcoming food conference is a once-in-a-lifetime moment. How so?
Yes, I believe so. And I would urge listeners this morning particularly, we know we will sell out for Thursday night for hearing Mr. Graves. So go to our website at mintmuseum.org and register. It's cheap to hear. Truly, it's
You've democratized it.
Indeed. $5 for Mint members. It's free for students and $15 for non-Mint members. And then the conference on Friday, again, bringing in these extraordinary people within their fields to have a conversation around something that we all work with and enjoy, food.
Yes.
How great is that?
It's an acronym in this case, Food, Objects, Objectives, Design. It's the conference on the 25th and 26th, Thursday and Friday, at the Mint Museum Uptown. Michael Graves will be speaking there on Thursday night at 7. I thank you for joining us, Mr. Graves. Pleasure talking to you. And Cheryl Palmer is the Director of Learning and Engagement at the Mint Museum. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you,
Thank
Mike.
You.
You're very welcome. Design is an aesthetic, so it applies to physical objects as well as to things you can't touch but can certainly feel. And design is the framework for the crafting of a season of entertainment, something that Blumenthal Performing Arts seems to be getting increasingly good at. We now get major hit shows before some of the larger cities, and we also have increasing opportunities to be exposed to new and different, sometimes quirky, but highly entertaining shows and performers that would never have played Charlotte were it not for the efforts of the Blumenthal. Much of the legwork that goes into wooing shows and performers to the Queen City and on to the season at the PAC is the responsibility of our next guests. Tom Gabbert has been president of Blumenthal Performing Arts for a decade now. Doesn't seem like that, but
it's really flown by.
Yeah. He also works with other regional organizations and with presenters in New York, both as a presenter himself and as a co-producer and investor in dozens of shows from Broadway to off-Broadway to London's West End. And he's been a Tony voter since 1997. Who's going to win this year?
Ooh, it's going to be a great year.
Douglas Young is Vice President of Programming at the Blumenthal, a man who never sleeps. And when he does, he's usually doing so in a hotel somewhere around the world as he scours the planet looking for new shows, new acts, new entertainment. I think you slept last night because I saw you last night at about 11 o'clock, and here you are this morning.
You know, I got to watch this incredible rehearsal for Charlotte Squawks Night. Since that put me to sleep.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the program, Douglas.
Thank you. Try to stay awake.
And joining us by phone is Meredith Blair, president of the Booking Group, one of the most prolific booking agencies in the Broadway touring business, overseeing the tours of Mamma Mia, Rent, The Producers, Legally Blonde, Avenue Q, to name just a few. Thank you for joining us from New York City.
My pleasure.
Now, those of us with some history know that the quantity and the quality of what's coming to town at the Blumenthal has risen substantially in the last 10 years or so. Is that because of you? Is it because that Charlotte is a growing city? Is it because we're becoming a city of people who actually buy tickets to more and more different kinds of things? Because there's more good product out there than ever before because of your connections as a producer? What's causing all this? Because it's true.
Well,
All of the above.
You know, ultimately, it's because we have great fans here that we're able to do all this. But that has been carefully nurtured. You know, people don't come to an appetite for these things on their own. That has to be nurtured. And we have, I think, worked very hard here to nurture that. But this is a smart community. This is a community that travels a lot, that's aware of these shows, and has a great interest in these things.
Mm-hmm. And it used to be, Meredith, that Broadway shows would be a hit on Broadway, and 3 or 4 or 5, maybe 6 years later, we would see one on the road. Now they're out sometimes before they go to Broadway, or they're out as soon as it becomes a bona fide hit on Broadway. Is there a concern on the part of the Broadway producers, and even you, that with two tours on the road, that you're diluting the effectiveness of the Broadway production?
With two tours on the road, of which production are you speaking about?
Let's talk about Book of Mormon, for instance.
No, I don't think that. There's such an enormous demand for the Book of Mormon. We're actually, there's more demand than we can actually supply at the moment. Most tours go out about the season following the season that they open in New York. They'll usually start a year to a year and a half after their opening in New York. And that's been the case for several years now. So I don't think there's anything new in that. It's just a question of whether or not a particular production can support more than one tour.
Mm-hmm. And you, I know, Douglas, go out and find a lot of, in addition to working on the Broadway tours, you go out and find a lot of shows that no one's ever heard of, acts that no one's ever heard of, and you bring them to town, and they're incredible. But if people would just come see them, they are incredible. How do you find these people?
You know, there's a ton of product that's out there, and I have to say, because of the success we've had on the Broadway side, people really want to come to Charlotte. They really love our audiences. They think we have really smart audiences. They that we have audiences who listen to the shows. And from the artist and producer point of view, that's really important. So a lot of times we are approached first before other markets are, because people really want to see how that works out.
I want to talk about that. I've heard this around town, that the people who come to Charlotte in these tours and the companies that manage these tours like Charlotte for all the reasons that you just said. But I want to hear it from Meredith in a second when we come back from the break about what it is about Charlotte and how different areas of the country respond differently to certain shows. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the law firm of Horak Talley, lawyers who negotiate to resolve disputes, handle complex business litigation, and protect clients' interests in court. Horak Talley, attorneys who get things done. And Communities in Schools, investing in Charlotte's future by bringing together corporate, faith, and community partners to help students be successful in school and in life. Details at CISCharlotte.org. The FAA furloughs of air traffic controllers are causing flight delays across the country. Diane Rehm and her guests talk about how the fight over budget cuts is affecting air travel. That's coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. It's all about design today. First, Michael Graves. He was earlier in the program, and now we're talking about how you put together a season of entertainment that has become increasingly more successful over the years at the Blumenthal. And we will continue that conversation in just a moment. Stay with us.
I'm Marco Werman. PRI's The World is News.
By this point, we've got more security forces just to keep people back for their own safety.
The world is changing.
There's a huge, huge number of young women veiled, but also wearing tight jeans and makeup.
The world is strange.
Posy Waller, which is a man inordinately fond of jam.
Join us on The World. Weekday afternoons at 3 on WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about how you put together a season of entertainment at the Blumenthal with the president of the North Carolina Blumenthal Performing Arts Center, Tom Gabbard. Douglas Young is vice president of programming there. And Meredith Blair joins us from New York. She's president of the Booking Group, one of the organizations that actually stages and books these tours that come around the country. We were talking about how different audiences respond in different parts of the country and how Charlotte is allegedly getting this reputation for having audiences that actually listen to the show, get into the show, understand the show, appreciate these shows. Have you found that to be the case on your end, really, Meredith? Let's be honest here. Is there really a difference between a Charlotte audience and a Chicago audience or an audience in Peoria?
Yes. Without naming other names, yes, Charlotte is a very sophisticated, cultured market with a hunger for what's current. And, you know, that's, I don't think that's an accident. That's been carefully cultivated and nurtured by the Blumenthal. And it's reflected in the audience's reception of what they're seeing. And they seem to be hungering for more. They don't, there are, without naming names, there are markets in the country that prefer to keep their programming a bit more conservative or traditional, and the Blumenthal consistently goes for what is considered in New York the best of Broadway. They don't censor their audiences. Which is, I think, really important. And I think that the audiences seem to respond to that they're not being coddled or babied or, you know, they're given the opportunity to choose what they want to see, and they seem to respond very well.
Well,
to it.
That, of course, brings up the Book of Mormon. And so before we talk about the Book of Mormon, which is on the season for next year, it could have been on this year's season, and you chose not to do it for various reasons. But you bring to town a lot of other fringe acts that are probably even more controversial in some ways than the Book of Mormon. Is that how you gauge whether or not we are ready for a show like the Book of Mormon, or is that the way you plant seeds to make us ready for shows like the Book of Mormon? I can't think of her name, but she was wonderful.
Meow, meow.
Meow, meow.
Cabaret artist.
Yes, wonderful. Wonderful, but pushing the envelope.
Well, you know, I think that part of it is this. We don't try to program so that people will come and see everything we do. Uh-huh. You know, we have a metropolitan area of almost 2 billion people, so our goal is really to do programming throughout the year that people will come and say, hey, that's something that's relevant to me. And so if we can do something that at least everyone can find one thing throughout mm-hmm. the season, that's really our goal, to try and have a diverse portfolio of shows so that people can actually come and see something that they enjoy, or they can look up on the stage and go, those people look like me. And I think that's really where we get the diversity in programming from.
Yes, the people on Broadway, people who go to New York and see shows have embraced the Book of Mormon. It is arguably one of the most popular musicals ever, and it's making its way around the country. Did you have any reservations about that, about bringing it here?
No. Once, actually, Meredith put together a group of key presenters that sat down very early, right after the show opened, with Scott Rudin. And when I asked Scott, I said, are you going to place any limitations on our ability to just be honest with people, to let them know, you know, that there are some content things that people are either going to love or hate? Are you going to place any restrictions on that? Are you going to limit our ability to deal with season ticket holders that don't want to see it? And when Scott said, I want you to be honest, and if you have subscribers who don't want to take it, we're going to work with you to let them switch out, things like that. Once I heard that, I had no problem whatsoever. I mean, this, because of the popularity of South Park,
yes,
people have a frame of reference.
This is a musical, not based on, but from the creators of South Park.
That is a beloved brand you know, has a huge fan base.
By the way, I think South Park, the movie musical, is the best movie musical ever made.
Well, the show just – I honestly was not that familiar with the brand. And as I became familiar and realized the millions and millions of fans, I had no concern about selling tickets. Yeah. But the key thing was we wanted to be respectful with our subscribers, to be absolutely transparent in our communication. And that applies when you talk about challenging content. You know, as long as we can be absolutely clear in our communications so that people have a heads up and can make their own personal choice.
We could have gotten the show.
Ultimately, the show doesn't want to have anybody there that doesn't want to be there. We're not trying to force the show on anyone. We would like it to be a choice. And so, of course, we're happy to have the presenter make sure that their audiences know what they're getting.
We could have gotten the show last year, and for various reasons you opted to put it on the schedule this year. But that begs the question, how is it that Charlotte could have gotten it? We're still getting it before Atlanta. So how is it that Charlotte could have gotten it way before Atlanta? What makes us able to do that?
Before it's actually within the same routing. I think you're within a couple of months of each other. It's purely a function of routing and logistics, and when the tour happens to be swinging through a certain part of the country.
But we could have gotten it last year. So how? What is it about Charlotte?
Actually, routing wise, that wouldn't have happened. We weren't in the South yet. There's only so many places. At that point, we only had one touring company.
Jump in there, Tom.
Only places we could get to. Pardon?
I think early on there was a question of how the show would play in the South, and we've been bullish from the get go and ready to play it.
Indeed, they have. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, there was no hesitation.
Are you getting pushback from other parts of the country on this show, Meredith?
Honestly, no. No, it's interesting. You know, I've been doing this a long time, and I remember when Rent opened, and the reaction was similar to the concerns that people have on this one. Was, oh my goodness, are the subscribers going to be able to handle this? Is this too edgy? Is this too off the beaten track? And there was all this talk about putting disclaimers in, and there was a lot of nervousness at first when Rent went out, and we were stunned by how embraced it was, and how there was actually hardly any negative reaction, and that actually became one of the longest tours in our history. We had it out for 14 years. Since then, other things have gone out that people have thought, "Ooh, gosh, is this just a little bit too much for the road?" And I think that we underestimate the audiences outside of New York by thinking that they can't handle things. Spring Awakening, Avenue Q. They were hugely embraced on the road, considered a bit edgy, but people loved them. And the same thing has been true here. We've been on the road now since last August and played everywhere from Des Moines to Chicago to Seattle to Denver, and the reaction has been stupendous. We have not had people walking out or people offended or that I'm aware of at all. It's been hugely embraced.
What do Charlotte audiences seem to like the most, Tom and Douglas?
Well, I think there's some traits that are similar to a lot of other communities. People are aware of the brands. You know, we have a lot of people that do travel to New York regularly, and so they're very aware. I think sometimes people don't understand that the number one travel stop out of Charlotte is New York for people that start their travel in Charlotte. So, you know, they're very aware of the brands and eager to see – you know, what they've seen advertised in New York.
Let's talk about how you do this, because putting together a season of entertainment, whether it's just the Duke Energy Broadway series or whether it's the countless other things that you put on the six stages that you control in this city, has got to be like putting together a microscopic jigsaw puzzle, because it's dependent on when shows can be here and what shows are available and what shows you want and what shows you don't want.
And multiple seasons. I've analogized it really to I think it was on Star Trek. They had the three-level chess game.
Right.
And so, we're talking multiple seasons. And there's sometimes Douglas will come into my office and we'll talk about something and I'll say, remind me which season we're talking about. So it's not just that mosaic of a given season, but then over the course of 3 years, what does that mosaic look like?
So when does it begin? Are you putting this together constantly throughout the upcoming next – you're looking ahead to 2017 now, or 2016 or 2015?
To 2016, yeah, believe it or not. Right now, you know, we're currently living in the 2012-2013 season. We still have Traces and War Horse and Catch Me If You Can left in this season before we switch over to the next season. And so, you know, 13-14 was just announced. We're working actively now on 14-15 with agents like Meredith right now. And we're also looking ahead to 15-16, because the way it really starts is you start looking at the tentpole shows, the big blockbusters, because that is what you start with to build your season around. And then everything else starts filling in, because you really have to keep an eye on what's happening on Broadway. There's a ton of shows opening right now that are potential shows out on the road, and you know, everyone wants to take a look and see how those shows are going to perform in New York. And then you see if there's enough interest out on the road for a show to go out. I mean, Meredith is a great example. We've worked with her on so many shows, and you know, there have been times where a show like a play like Harvey is something that a lot of people are interested in, but there's just not enough interest with people who want to present a play to get a play like Harvey out on the road.
That was going to be with John Boy, right, from the Waltz?
With yes,
I can't think of his
Richard
name.
Richard Thomas.
Yeah. Yes,
and the process really goes even further than that. Sometimes to just providing seed money to these productions that may or may not happen. I mean, this season on Broadway, we're investors in six shows. We'd like to see all of those tour. At the end of the day, we know that some of those won't be able to create enough weeks to tour, but we will help prime the pump by putting investments in these shows.
Is that a new phenomenon for regional presenters, you and others around the country who have similar facilities and similar programming challenges, to actually become – quote unquote producers of these Broadway shows, so that they get their fingers in the pie?
Yeah, we've actually been a key leader in that, in creating a group called the Independent Presenters Network, that are 40 of our colleagues from across the country that are like us, mainly nonprofits. And we pool our funds so that we can acquire typically a 10% ownership interest in the show. And that's happened within the last 15 years and is becoming increasingly important, because the typical investment sources in New York are going away, or at least struggling. And so people like us really are key to making sure that new productions form and happen.
We've only mentioned The Book of Mormon, and there are lots of other shows coming next year that I want to at least mention. When does the season begin? Does it begin before or after The Lion King comes here again?
It technically begins for us, because we have eight shows that are part of the season and eight bonus shows. So Lion King, which was part of the 12-13 package, actually becomes a bonus show. So we actually start in August with two shows, The Lion King and I Love Lucy Live on Stage.
Which I saw a little clip of that yesterday. It's astounding. It looks exactly like the television show, except it's in color.
Exactly, and that's a great thing about it is the audience gets to watch two episodes if they were in the studio being filmed, and it's that great experience. And they've got fantastic performers, particularly for Lucy. So that'll be a lot of fun for folks.
Book of Mormon, you're very devilish, and when you're opening that, you're opening that on December 26th. but you're also bringing a new production of Evita, Andrew Lloyd Webber's Evita, to town. What is different about this go-around?
Well, this is the production that just closed on Broadway, was originally produced in London, and it has the song from the film that's been interspersed to it. It has a lot of new video footage that didn't even exist when the original one was done. The look of it is far more realistic. It's not staged in the black box that Hal Prince originally did. It is an absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous production.
Hmm. And you're also bringing George Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, which will excite a lot of people out there. Is this the Diane Paulus American Repertory Theater production that was
Indeed
in New York?
Indeed it is, yes.
Yes, and which won the Tony for Best Revival last year.
Yes.
So, yeah, we've got in this season, we have the winners for Best New Musical and Best Revival, but totally reconceived book. It's contemporized in all the right ways. I mean, her drug addiction is clear in this, in a way that's kind of smoothed over in the original. These characters are far more real, far more engaging.
Yeah, this was I take it, Meredith, by your reaction to this, that your company is the company that's bringing this around the country, right?
Yeah, we're enormously proud of this production and delighted that Charlotte brought it in. Diane Paulus, by the way, is also directing this year the new production of Pippin that is getting ready to open this Thursday, as a matter of fact. She's really become quite a prominent director in New York. She also did the Tony Award-winning production of Hair several years ago. So, yeah, she's an astounding creative person, and this is a beautiful production, and we're really, really delighted that Charlotte's bringing it in.
And she's one of the people that kind of pushed through a lot of controversy. She just kept trucking along during the rehearsal stages of this at Harvard and beyond, and persevered, and the other came out the other side kind of triumphant.
She did.
Yeah.
True.
You're also bringing Once to town. This is a little tiny thing. It's not tiny, but it's based on a couple who make music in Ireland. It was a movie first, right?
Yeah, it was. And honestly, when I looked at the movie, I thought, how is somebody going to make this into a musical? And they did in a just incredibly glorious way. There's a sweetness about this show. It moves people in incredible ways. So when we talk about it as a small show, it's not physically a small show, but it moves people in this emotional way that you're used to only seeing with something that is a little bit smaller.
Douglas, you have 6 stages to fill with people and 6 auditoriums to fill with people. How do you do it? I mean, do we buy enough tickets to sustain that kind of activity? Because you have things in there almost every night.
Well, I mean, we're very lucky. You know, on our stages throughout the year, we will have anywhere in the given season 800 to 1,000 performances. Out of those performances, we will either present or produce somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 to 400 or more performances. Then we have resident companies like the Symphony, the Opera, the Dance Theater, who do their performances as well, and they choose their own programming. But, you know, what we're finding is that people are looking for more entertainment options. And I think that's a great indication that the economy is turning around, or at least people are feeling more comfortable and more confident about going out and using their money.
And not everything is brutally expensive. I think Meow Meow was not terribly expensive, but it was remarkably entertaining.
Right. I mean, and that's the thing, is we try to have enough diversity. I mean, you know, just this week alone, we had David Sedaris in the Belk Theater. And you know, David is really committed to keeping prices low. And part of that was also he was doing the book release for his new book on the night that he was here. So that was pretty exciting.
You can get all this information about the Broadway series on the Blumenthal website. But don't just think of it as a place to go see Broadway shows, although that's the big moneymaker. There are thousands of things that come here, hundreds of things that come here every year that are really worth seeing that you would never dream are in Charlotte. And they may only be here for 1 or 2 nights, but when they come, they're sensational in most cases. Meredith Blair, president of the Booking Group, Douglas Young, vice president of the programming at the PAC, and Tom Gabbard, president of the Blumenthal Performing Arts Center. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate it.